the question again. That was, how did you feel the person on, taking the family out of the company out of the family for the first time? That was what you were doing.
Well, I really wasn't taking the family out of the company. It was the first non-Haas CEO. And frankly, I had no qualms about it. Because number one, I'd had tremendous experience in Europe. I'd built all these little companies up until they were now 30% of the company's business. So I had experience at all levels in building a company. And I knew that the total was, I knew all the different parts of the company. And I knew that it was something that I could handle. And especially since I had the full support of Otto and his brother John, although John really had not much to do in those days. He was director of purchasing or something like that. But a nice guy. But I would meet with Otto once a week, and Otto gave me his full support. And as I said, everybody that was senior to me before the thing had came in and said that they offered me their full support, and all said they voted for me, even the three or four that hadn't. But so that I knew I had the team behind me. The thing that bothered me most was that I could see that Roman Haas had been caught up in the 1960s acquisition boom that the chemical industry got itself in, and they had far too. They thought that growth of the 60s was going to continue, and two things happened: the acquisitions didn't all work out, and the second thing is the rate of growth of the chemical industry dropped off in the latter part of the 60s and from then on, and we had too many people. So I knew this was the thing that bothered me, and I knew that I had to get rid of about 10 to 15% of the salaried people. And there was a tradition in the company: no salaried person ever got laid off or fired except for, you know, stealing something. I mean, in economic conditions, you didn't do it. And even hourly people, there was a tendency to keep them on. During the Depression, old Mr. Haas paid people from the Philadelphia and Bristol plants to come in Philadelphia and clean the streets because he didn't have any work for them, but he kept them on the payroll. So here I have to get rid of 10 or 15% of the salaried people. That was the toughest job. That gave me a lot of pause, but we did it correctly, and I managed to get by.
Yeah, that's... I'm sure raised some eyebrows. You're in the saddle not very long, and that becomes one of your principal objectives.
Yeah, well, but on the... It raised eyebrows, but on the other hand, it was so obvious to everybody that it was necessary to be done that nobody could fight the principle. Now they said, well, here is the policy of Roman Haas changed. I said, yeah, it's changed, but I said, this is voluntary. If we'll it's voluntary to this extent, we're going to eliminate these positions. And if there's no longer a position, and the individual, if we don't have a job for the individual somewhere else, then we might say you've got to take a lower position somewhere. And if you don't take that, then you're going to have to find yourself another job. And then we would give you a severance thing. So there was a big element of voluntary in it. But there was also some teeth behind it, too. And we got I think the goal was 10%, and we got 15%. Now, some of the people didn't handle it as well as others, and there was some bitterness in the research division because it had handled badly there, because there, the guy in charge said, Gregory wants 10%, we're going to give him 15%, and you know, it was bad. And the other thing I did was I set up what I called the Court of Last Appeal, and I went around talking to people, and I would meet them in groups of 20 or 30. Do you have any questions about the program? And also, everybody had, after they'd gone through two layers of supervision and hadn't got satisfaction, they had the right to come to me personally and see me alone on the thing. And about 20 or 30 did, but nothing very serious. They were all taken care of one way or another.
When you say 10%, did you do this 10% of every department, 10%? How did you... Select a 10%.
It was across the board.
Across the board,
yeah. That was not very scientific. But on the other hand, we were moving people in and out in here so that not everybody suffered 10%. But that was the the policy that was that now is we're going to reduce 10%.
What time frame? How long did it take to do that?
18 months.
18 months. You also worked to change the composition of the board.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most important things that I did. Mr. Haas didn't believe in outside directors. In fact, the only reason we had outside directors in his time is because the government seized his partner, his German partner's share of Roman Haas Philadelphia, and took it. The alien property custodian took it and put on two outside directors, a guy from Kidder Peabody and another guy from Drexel, when Drexel was a Philadelphia bank, and put them on. And now these, it turned out these guys in time became good friends of Mr. Haas and helped and didn't hinder the company's growth. But he always said and told both of his sons, don't have outside directors. And if you do, get friends and put them on the board. They don't know anything about the company. And this was the mindset. When I took over, now the first couple years I was so busy with this other program and doing some things I didn't have much time for. But then when we got the oil shock and it was so clear that my instincts of being in fibers, that we shouldn't be in fibers, were right, that I decided, you know, we can't have this. We have to have a board of directors in which there'd be a majority of independent directors. They got to be strong, and they got to be able to give advice and discipline to the CEO and the rest of the whoever else needs it. And I discussed it with Otto, and he said, well, it's a new concept. He said, but if you think that's right, and he said, it'll affect you more than anybody. And I said, that's right. So he agreed, and that's when we set a goal of 10 outside directors and five inside directors, and I got there within a couple of years. And actually, that was a time when not every company was doing this, and we got a lot of credit from people like at the Harvard Business School, where I got the dean of the business school on the board as part of that. And we came up with a very, very strong board. Bruce Hanna, you may have heard of Bruce. He was head of research for Bell Labs.
I'm going to be talking to him next month.
Really?
Yes.
We're out in Seattle?
No, in Baltimore. He's coming to Baltimore for a board meeting, so I'm going to catch
right?
up with him there.
Is he on a board?
Yes, he's got a meeting in Baltimore and one in New York.
Jesus, he's a little long in the tooth for boards, isn't he?
He wanted me to interview him on the Metroliner between Baltimore and New York. I said, well, I'd rather not do that. So
he's a good friend of mine. But, you know, I go out to the University of Washington. I'm going out next week. And occasionally I see him out there, but not so much anymore. But I got him on the board. And I got him on the board because he was doing some work with our research people. And the director of research told me, why don't you talk to Bruce Hanna? They knew that I wanted a scientist on the board who would give us some outside scientific input. And so I met him and talked to him, and after we talked for a couple of hours, it suddenly dawned on me that this guy wanted the job himself. So I said, would you be interested? Oh, yes! And through him, we got Gil Ullman. Does that name mean anything to you?
No.
He's a head of the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of Washington. And I got him to serve in an environmental advisory council that I set up. Now, this is something new that we started at Roman Haas. They were made up of two outside scientists and two outside directors. And they were there reporting to the board of directors, and they were, number one, auditing what management was doing and advisors to management as to what we should be doing in the area of environmental safety, health, and environment. And we got Hanna recommended this guy Ullman, who's great. He's an MD from Harvard. So he was so good that we finally asked him to join the board, and he did, and he's still on the board. And I see him once or twice a year when I go out to the University of Washington to help his gang.
It must have been obvious to the, I'm going to say, quote, regular employees, that you were a different person, that your style was different, your management was different, and there were going to be a lot of changes in the company.
That's right.
Did you get out to communicate with them and talk to them?
Oh, yes. Yeah, see, I'd spend one day a month at research, out at research, and I'd talk to some of the people. I'd have a program before I went out, and they would work on their program, where I would go through maybe what we were doing in the next advance in water-based adhesives or water-based whatever. It could be any subject, but I would follow that. Then I would have a group of about 50 that would have lunch with me, and then after lunch I would get up and talk to them for 15 or 20 minutes about what we were doing in the company and why we were doing this and why we're not doing that. So it was a very good way to communicate. And I would go to the plants. I'd go to the bigger ones more often than the little ones. And I would also go to the sales meetings. And finally got smart and gave my speech while they were having one cocktail and take another one and sit down. And I give my speech rather than wait until they gave out the golf prizes and they were all drunk at 9 o'clock and didn't know what the hell I said anyway. But no, I got around because I believed in. There's only one way to deliver a real message if you want cooperation and people understand. That's personally.
You were not technically trained.
No.
And yet you've been a strong supporter of R&D.
Right.
How did R&D feel initially with a non-technically trained person as CEO of the company? Do you have any feel for that?
I think some of them had some qualms at first. The top people did not, because, as I said, the chairman of the board, who was head of R&D for many years, Dr. Connor, Ralph Connor, was well respected, and he knew me from my work in Europe, and he came to see me, and the fellow that he picked knew me. So I didn't have any resistance. And another thing that happened, I was made CEO in September. The following June, we got a message that Norton Nelson, the scientist at NYU, had discovered that this product of ours was a very, very strong carcinogen, and he proved that what we suspected, that there was some problem at the Philadelphia plant, and he found out which one it was. Well, then the way I conducted myself then, just shut down all the plants and made sure they were right and got the research people involved and hired some people that knew what they were doing in that area instead of organic chemists. I got a lot of kudos from that out of the research people handling it in that fashion. And then the other thing too was my visits to research and talking to them and telling them what we needed. And the other thing that over the years when I was in Europe, I had made almost a missionary out of the fact that you can't do research in a cocoon out there at Springhouse any more than you can ask the marketing people just to sell whatever you make, and you need a marriage between marketing and research. And they all believed in this, except the guys, there was too much pride at the top in some cases, and I broke that down, and that helped. But having said all that, though, not being a PhD in chemistry, it was something to in the chemical industry. When I came in the industry, most of the company heads were chemists, chemical engineers, PhD, and of course that's changed over the years. There were some reservations, but I think I knocked most of those down, especially when I, after two or three years, said that one of our objectives is to double research in real terms over 5 years. Of course, they all liked that. We never quite got there.
That happened in 72, and I understand that it didn't quite double it, though, that it got scaled down later.
It got scaled down when we got hit with the oil shock and also decided that we better get out of fibers, and we took a real knock on that one.
I wanted to ask you about the fiber business, and maybe this is the point to do it. When you took over in 70, the handwriting was really already was on the wall to a certain extent about fiber. The company was in the fiber business already, had been initiated by others. You were hearing from the fiber people that they were still optimistic about the fact that this could succeed, and so you decided to continue pursuing it for a while. Is that correct?
Well, it's close to being correct, but when I was made CEO, we had a product which was a stretch product like Lycra, DuPont's Lycra. Okay. And at the time when I was CEO, our product, which we hadn't put into production, and we were just about to put into production at Fayetteville, our product really was superior to Lycra because Lycra yellowed in those days. And so but even so, when I looked at DuPont and some of these other people and our position, and I got scared. And I said to Otto and to Ralph Connor, chairman of the board and the former and the director of research and the former CEO, former, I said, I think we should get out. And they said, Otto said, would you give it one try for me? He said, because so many people have invested so much of their time and energy and reputation in this. He said, we'd like to do it and see if we can't make Animate a success. So I said, okay. Well, that part was a little mistake, but it was a mistake. Where I made my biggest mistake, though, is when DuPont improved Lycra so that it was better on the top scale of ours, and then the double knit polyesters came in, and they had the stretch, and they took out the bottom part of that, and there was really no place for us in that market. And that's for sure when we should have got the hell out. But I didn't, because the old guy I used to work with for a year, he sold me this bill of good, by God, polyester, and we can do it better. I said, why can we do it better than DuPont? Or, hey, well, they got all their know-how from ICI, so don't worry about that. We could do it, and that was a big mistake. And
You actually converted the Fayetteville plant, didn't you, over to
which was
polyester.
A portion of it, yeah. It was making nylon, and we converted a portion of it to polyester. That's right. And built a new one. We just didn't convert. We built, too.
And as I understand, that's when the bottom dropped out of that market, too, around that
right.
time.
That's right. That's right. See, that was the oil shock was involved in it, too, because oil and energy in those synthetic fibers were a major cost of them, and the cost went up, and it was a big boys game from then on. But we got out.
And you made that decision.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I made that decision. And that also was one of the things that convinced me that we did not have a strong board of directors. Because I thought if we had a strong board of directors and outsiders that would stand up, when a new CEO comes in with most of his experience in Europe and doesn't really understand this fibers business and is going on, they should have said, okay, have a look at. Nobody said a damn word to me about, you know, maybe you better take another look at this or something like that. We don't think it's going to fly or something. Not a word. I need some guys on there that will level with me.
There was a point, though. I think the year you got out in '76, but the year before, I think you were still telling the board that you weren't. Am I right in that or not? Or at the stockholders meeting, whatever it was.
I thought it was the stockholders. I don't know exactly the dates, but there was about a year when I told, and the security analyst, that was more important than telling the security analyst, no, we're in this and we're going to make it. And, you know, and when I told him that, I thought we were, this is when Animate for sure went down. There was still some lingering hope that we could make it work, and also in polyester, we had supposedly a better process, and then it became very clear that we were losing our damn shirts in the thing. So you're right. I mean, I 1 year afterwards, and I told them we're getting out, and I took some heat on that one.
I can imagine.
Yeah,
it's got to be a real nightmare to have essentially two things at once that you had great hopes for that aren't going to work and are costing a lot of money at the same time.
That's exactly right. And it was at the time with the oil shock and oil prices shooting up and our raw material costs going up. So 1974, 75, they were tough years. They were my two toughest years here. I think profit-wise, 75 is the one when it really hit, but 74 was no great thing either.
One interesting thing about the fiber business the fiber situation, is that when something like that magnitude happens, usually somebody's head rolls.
Right.
That's putting it crudely, but it, frequently that's what happens, and it didn't happen here. And I remember Ben Branch telling me at Dow that he made mistakes, and the board picked him up and said, keep on going.
Yeah.
And you essentially had the same thing.
Well, you see, by this time, we didn't have in place yet the strong outside board of directors. So the board was still dominated by me and by the two Haases. John wasn't too much involved. He was working with the foundation and other things. But Otto was. And, of course, Fibers was really his baby. And so it would have been difficult for him. But, you know, I think it was one of the Chem Week or I don't know who the hell it was, asked me that same question. Maybe you've seen it just about that time. And said, you know, most companies, when something like this happened, heads begin to roll, the CEO would go. And so why didn't you go? And I said, well, I lost so goddamn much money for the company, they can't afford to train a replacement. And I never thought the guy would print it. He had it on the cover. But I got some mileage out of that one.
Well, not only were you going through the fiber problem at that time and the energy crisis, but as you mentioned before, you had this problem, this environmental problem with the bisachloromethyl ether,
right?
And I think it was in 71, that was one of the things that impressed me, is that once you knew the evidence was there, you had a problem, you immediately took action,
right?
You know, the chemical industry has a long history of stonewalling on issues like this, and that's now changed, but
You're right. At the time,
that was not the case.
You're right. Well, I did take some flack from some of the management people and board members for shutting down the plants, and I took that as my own decision. I didn't even consult the board on that,
because
I didn't want to get them involved. I said, we shut down the plant. I had a meeting over, it was over a 4th of July weekend. As soon as we had the fact from this guy Nelson and his work, and it was rats, not mice, and so forth, I shut them down and keep them down until we get them cocoons around them and stuff that they wouldn't come out the top, and crash program to develop a monitor and so forth. So we did the right things there, and we got credit for that. But what you're talking about is after that, when the Toxic Substance Control Act was up, Nader's group were lobbying to have it passed, and they came up and got in touch with some of the families, the widows at the Philadelphia plant. And damn me, I learned about 3 hours before it happened, they had a press conference and said Roman Haas is one of these people, and they've killed all these people, and oh, we had a hell of a mess. And then we were attacked. The Philadelphia Inquirer was involved in it. They were attacking us. And but I don't know if you knew about the Senator Church's committee was holding hearings on this, and they called me down on the act and to testify with this background, and so the CMA was then called the MCA, and Ed Cain, the then president of DuPont, was head of the MCA. So I called him and I said, the MCA, I know this is going to testify on Wednesday, I'm testifying on Monday, and this is what I'm going to testify, that Roman Haas is in favor of this act, this proposed act, but there are some problems with it, and we would like to have the privilege of helping with the markup. And he goes, oh, wait a minute. So he thinks, let me get back here. So he came back about 3 or 4 hours later, and he said, okay. He said, well, that'll be our testimony too. Now we got to be. I went down. That's what I testified. And when I walked out, this was awful, because Nader had the whole thing set up, and I went down there. They had about 8 or 10 of the widows, 3 or 4 of the kids, all sitting around what would be the witness table. And the church says, "Well," they said. They came my turn to testify. I said, It's your turn now, Mr. Gregory. He said, I don't know what we're going to do with these people. He said, that's the only place. He said, what do you want me to do with them, move them? And I said, no, they're my people. I'll sit with them. I don't care. I know most of them. I knew some of them. I would come a little hostile, but most of them were not. So, and then there were seven or eight senators there. So I said, I'm going to submit a written statement, but before I start, I just want to tell you that that I support your act with the, although there's some things in it that we think can be improved, and we'd like the privilege of helping with the markup. And he said, you support it? And I said, yes. And you support it? And everybody left except Weicker and Church. They just got up and walked out. They said, well, we have no more business with you.